The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
It is News Talk, the Anton Savage Show, 9 to 11 on Saturday, 10 to 12 on Sundays. With me this morning is Ursula Savage, political commentator, Philip Ryan, head of content with the Sunday Times Ireland, and cancer specialist John Cren. John, do I go by doctor or professor? Or are you both? You're technically both.
Call me anything you want, just don't call me early in the morning.
We'll stick with John on that basis. Now, a lot of coverage in the papers relating to politics and Michael Lowry being part of it, and his pride, apparent pride, at having cabinet ministers ostensibly report to him on a weekly basis. We will get to that. The more pressing issue seems to be concern over the coalition's performance on housing. And in this instance, the concern, according to the Sunday Independent, comes from within the coalition, because they're saying coalition unease over housing ministers' performance. Philip Ryan, this is a suggestion that Jim O'Callaghan has come out of the traps very fast and very impressive, and has grabbed his brief with both hands, whereas James Brown, the housing minister, so far has little to show for his new appointment.
Yeah, but you could look at it from a different direction as well, in that essentially what Jim O'Callaghan is doing is implementing the policies of his predecessor around deportations, in around the immigration pieces anyway, and some of the crime and security too. And then do you have to look at James Brown, and he's looking at what was left behind by Dara O'Brien, who seems to have made one of the smartest moves in the current cabinet by getting the hell out of the Department of Housing and moving elsewhere. So
there are no quick wins, because everybody keeps talking about things like whether it's living above the shop, or even the story that juxtaposes beside that one, building sector seeking 10-week deadline for water connections, those kind of things of connections to water, connections to ESB, fast tracking of planning. Are there not things that he can
someone
pick
who's
off?
Just moved into a new home, that was the biggest delay. Getting the water connected, getting the electricity connected. It is. It's farcical that this is the problem. And then you can see the Mail has a story as well about the completion dates, that commencement dates that just are nowhere near where they should be and are actually going backwards. And then, like you say, you have another story in the Sunday Independent from Wayne O'Connor about this tenant in situ scheme, which was supposed to help people who were getting kicked out of homes by landlords, someone the councils would move in. That's not working. So, look, Brown, as a minister, I've known him for a few years now. It's like he's not, you know, all sparkles and shiny like Dara O'Brien going on shows like yourself, and you can throw anything at him and nothing seems to bounce off him. He's going to take a different approach to Dara O'Brien. He'll probably be a bit more behind the scenes. And look, the other side of it is we're very early into this coalition. So,
well, that's the thing. Are we? We're what, 115, 120 days at this point? Like, clock's ticking. And it's not like they arrived and had to make fundamentally new relationships with the civil service. It's the same bunch of people, albeit slightly different deck chairs.
Well, then, yeah, let's just call a spade a spade. Maybe Dara didn't do great.
Ursula, your take on this, plus the thing in relation to the commencement, which is a significant issue, that if we're seeing a slowdown in commencement, it greatly reduces the chances of hitting the 40-odd thousand that we thought we'd hit last year and very much need to hit this year.
Well, that's a massive issue. And I think nearly the housing targets are becoming sort of like figures in the air at this stage, because they seem to be formulated and never actually have any sort of strategy as how they're planning to achieve that. And going back to what Philip was saying there about how, you know, maybe he's doing a bit of background work, that actually was in the Sunday Independent article by Gabby Geddes-Viciacha and Mary Regan. They actually have a quote from the department saying that you're not going to see anything happen overnight because they're working on planning and strategy of services and infrastructure. But like Philip said, they weren't starting out from scratch here. They weren't starting out saying, like, you know, what do we actually need? Like, I mean, they didn't find out last week that they need to connect water to these homes. So, yes, you know, you're not going to get many quick wins with housing with a problem that's kind of so pervasive and so, you know, kind of in every single sector. That's there. But there are some kind of, like, they're not getting the quick wins, but they've managed to get quick losses. Like, this mess that's happening with the housing SAR and the housing activation unit and all that craziness and the mess up that happened over, like, they were appointing Brent McDonagh, then they weren't, and who are they going to appoint now? That's all kind of, that's noise that's not necessary. And that must be very frustrating for James Brown, but also I would say very frustrating for the entire coalition. And that's probably why we're seeing these briefings coming out, maybe not against the minister, maybe that'd be too strong a term so much to put it, but it is a government issue. And I think if we look back to the book that came out by Owen Murphy last year, and he talked about how housing is a government issue and it needed a government approach and they needed to treat it like a crisis. I think the fact that you're seeing government ministers coming out now and saying that they're not happy with one minister's performance is showing that that message really didn't sink in from somebody who really was in the belly of the beast at that stage.
Whatever about the embarrassment of the failed appointment of Brendan McDonagh, Philip, how impactful do you think it has been in terms of actual delivery? Because the idea was that whoever got that role was going to gather together the kind of loose strands that you've been describing in respect of infrastructure connections to ESB, to water, all the rest of it. We still don't have somebody in what was touted as a critical role.
Well, the bit about this I always get confused with, and I'm sure some smart minister or politician could explain it to me, but is that we set up the Land Development Agency, and I was always under the impression that was the agency that was going to unlock all this land and make sure there was the construction-ready sites all around the country for developers to basically walk in and throw up a house and it'd be done and dusted before the afternoon is over. So then we need this activation office, and it was handled badly in that, like, look, they floated out the name. You'd wonder if Brendan McDonagh probably found out he was going to be the housing czar in the papers as well. He's a very accomplished guy, it appears. The salary, I don't know. You have to pay for what you want as well. Like, and he's obviously not going to be taking up that role, but you'd wonder, is he going to get a job elsewhere for...
John, does this ring any bells to you back in the day with the start of the HSE? Do you remember we had Brennan, we had Prospectus, we had the health strategy, we had the disassembly of the health boards, all with a view to fixing an intractable problem? And you'd say 20 years on, it's hard to say that's job done.
I know, it was like endless reshuffling of the deck chairs on the Titanic at the time. I mean, it really was. It was disassembled and reassembled. I mean, I guess from our point of view, it's great that health is no longer considered the punishment station in government. I think housing is now probably considered the most unattractive ministerial position. I think part of the problem, which is probably one people don't like to hear, part of the problem is the market. I mean, this is an expensive country and everything is expensive here. And people in general, I know there is a lot of wealth inequality and a lot of people are still suffering. But in general, there's been just a massive increase in the ambient level of wealth in this country. The number of people who are comfortably off is just vastly higher than it was 30 years ago. And that kind of stuff puts enormous pressure on the cost of housing. If there are more people buying houses that have money, prices will go up.
But does it not also, theoretically, should it not also incentivize construction? If you're in the construction industry and you're saying, well, there's buckets of money flying around, well, I am therefore incentivized to start putting up some apartments. But that doesn't seem to be happening.
I would not claim to be expert on what the obstacles to that are, but I mean, there is a general tendency for this country to be highly bureaucratized and regulated and for, you know, new initiatives to require an awful lot of approval. I mean, the other thing I often wonder, and I have to be careful saying this too, is, you know, a lot of other countries, well-off countries, there is a culture that people are comfortable with the idea that they will rent a home for throughout their life. And that is just not in the Irish psyche. We really very much, I guess, because most of us are more than two or three generations away from somebody who owned a farm, we do like to feel that we will own our own little piece and it will be ours. And, you know, that's a lovely feeling to have it. But certainly incredibly successful economies like Germany and other places, there'd be a high percentage of people in Sweden and, you know, who rent apartments or who, you know, have rental accommodation, because the rental sector is set up not for kind of quick short-term gain for landlords, but is set up as an actual part of society. This is where people will live and there's appropriate rent. Even in like New York, there is rent control and rent regulation. And one wonders if we shouldn't be looking at that as a partial solution to the problem as well. It might be one of those things that might encourage some older people to relinquish the houses they own if they felt that there was some secure kind of accommodation.
Although even that, which is an area where you think there might be consensus, anytime we talk about that incentivization of older people to downsize, we get fairly furious text response from some of that cohort saying, I built this house, I made that garden, and I am not moving out of it in my dotage when I want to enjoy it.
I don't think
it.
People should be forced to, but I mean, if it made sense to people to do it, if there was something better for them to do, they might consider it. I'm an older person myself now. I mean, I have a young child in addition to older children, and, you know, I personally want to stay living in my house, and I do understand that people wouldn't want to do it. But one does see the logic for many people in different living circumstances of having a degree of downsizing.
Philip, how much is the political pressure on this matter being felt, do you think, in government? Because I'm always taken by the fact that the same people who were responsible for the issues 6 months ago were returned by the electorate, which has to do something to alleviate the pressure.
And they have a good 4 and a bit years to sit back and do something. Now, at the same time, politicians are always thinking about the next election because that's how they get their livelihood. That's how they pay for their dinner and keep a roof over their family's heads. So they have to be thinking of like improving this situation. And with the housing situation, it has, when did it start? Would we say 2012, 2013 that we decided once the ghost estate suddenly became back to life? And then we've been talking about the same thing for years and years. And now it's easy.
I can remember the Dublin Housing Action Committee in the 60s and 70s.
There you go.
We have had a long running story, and I think it's possibly just becoming more prominent now because, you know, there were more people that reckon I have, by virtue of my income or my status, I have the entitlement to have a home, and why don't I have one? Mm. And those people often are amongst the more vocal in society. They have access to, more channels for making their opinions known, and it's becoming, I think, more of an issue.
And you also have the people who should be empty nesters but aren't, because they have all their kids at home.
Well, that's the question. Is there a legitimacy to that view, though, John? I mean, presumably there are a lot of people who say, I did the right thing. I got an undergraduate degree. I got the master's. I got a very good job. I have a very good income. I'm ticking all the boxes, but I can't afford a house in the community that I grew up in.
I think that is a huge reason why it's getting the prominence it is, because a lot of those people are, you know, more upwardly socially mobile. They're more connected. They have more opportunities for connecting with politicians. And I think it is. And I think poorer people have suffered through housing problems for years in Ireland. Mm. This is not a new problem for them.
But I think too, in addition to that, I do see what you mean, but I think also a generation ago, two generations ago, you could have had a one income household where the house mightn't have been very grand, or it mightn't have been, you know, and like I said, there were always housing pressures, but people might have grown up in homes where one income was enough to sustain a household, to sustain paying the rent or the mortgage. That would be a pipe dream now, to think that one person could run a household with a family within it without all the additional pressures that are coming. They can't even get on the ladder. They can't even have security in the rental sector. So it's not even just those that say, like, this is my entitlement. It's like, this is what I've always known for many people. And they can't imagine that within the space of one generation, it's gone from one wage would be enough to sustain a household to people on two incomes can't get the bare basics in place.
I think we're saying the same thing. I mean, the market forces have pushed the price of houses up together, but, you know, the market forces is, number one, more people with money to buy them, and also an actual shortage of housing stock. So, you know, I mean, everything is expensive in Ireland. You know, it is. It's an expensive country now. So, but they do need to fix the supply side of the problem. And that I guess, is where government, probably through regulation rather than through direct building and through tax incentives, I think, need to have some kind of a crash course to make it an attractive thing to do.
Well, text agreeing with you. We need a new NAMA for residential property. Families in mortgage arrears, landlords selling up. This will stop the ever-increasing homelessness figures. The government will build their housing stock without delay and red tape in planning. None of the charities are buying distressed mortgage arrears. It's a win-win situation. Another, we want to own our own houses as there is no security in renting. Another, a lot of the apartments available to rent are either too expensive, too small, or not up to a good standard. 53106 at a cost of 30 cents if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. Philip, the government probably thought that they were at the point where the Michael Lowry issue, that being the fact that he had led the charge of the regional independence and led their negotiations, that it had kind of abated and some of the pressure had come off. Big splash in the front of the Sunday Times. Lowry, senior ministers give us weekly briefings.
Yeah. So this is from a deep dive into how, by Jennifer Bray and Claire Scott, into how the government is actually operating. What is the independence doing? How do they justify this term of being government TDs themselves while sitting on the opposition benches, or however that works? And that led to Michael Lowry wanting to very much get his point across that he does have a lot of influence. He is in there. And as you can see from the piece, he has ministers who are called essentially before his court, which he oversees on a weekly basis to give not only him briefings, but also the regional independence group, who quite remarkably includes the TDs who are in government, the ministers, your Sean Canny's, your Noel Grealish, Michael Healy-Ray, and then you also, and the other members of the group who don't have ministries. But then there's also these others like Matty McGrath and Carol Nolan, who are just do not support the government, but are members of this regional group, who presumably have access to these informal briefings from, like, Minister Hayden was in there, was it last week with them? Mm. Jim O'Callaghan's due, Colin Brophy's due.
Or is this unusual? My understanding was that when you did a deal with Jackie Healy-Ray, that line of "he stays bought," that's it, you did the deal, now go away and we'll see you post the next election. Weekly briefings?
Yeah, I know. It seems a little bit more formalised than any of those previous arrangements with independents. Obviously, when you had the Independent Alliance, like, they were very much embedded in and they were all ministers. But, for the most part, But in this instance, yes. And the other side of this that's worth bearing in mind is that there has been, since all the stuff blew up, since the abandoned vote for Micheál Martin as Taoiseach, that there has been steps by not only the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael's TDs to go like, oh yeah, look, it's a small arrangement. They're not really part of government, etc., etc. But also within the regional independent group, you had Barry Heenahan running across the other side of the Dáil because he didn't want to be pictured by him like a kid in school or something. And then you had but now it appears that Barry pops along to meetings that are chaired by Michael.
What does it say about the government, John, to be willing to be in regular briefing relationships with a man found by a tribunal of inquiry to be involved in corruption of a breathtaking degree?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you have to understand the nature of the contract that Deputy Lowry has with his constituents. You know, he is intensely focused on local issues, and he quote unquote delivers for them. That's what he tells them he's going to bring to them, and he will bring influence. So I think it's extremely unlikely that he's going to have a tendency to understate the level of influence he has in government. I think it's likely that he's amplifying this a little bit. I think it speaks to a much more profound problem, which I've been exercised about for years and years in this country, which is the completely artificial division between our two political parties, which gives rise to this bizarre situation where there is a general consensus in this country around centrist, non-crazy politics. But we continually, over the years, have a habit of, because the two sort of centrist parties and what was a third centrist party that's now very small, you know, could never actually work out, you know, really obscure details of their own governance and their own independence, that we always handed the balance of power to some of the people that really shouldn't have been in the position of balance of power. And it wasn't just, I don't want to personalize this to Michael Lowry, but there's been a long track record of these people who would be.
But you could argue that the issue that we have now is the opposite, that we have for the first time a right-left split. We have a left opposition, we have a centre-right government, and still the balance of power lies with independence.
More so than, you're correct, it's less than it was, but I do believe that there would have been efficiencies if the two parties hadn't spent so much time sniping at one another and had actually concentrated on the things which they held in common.
Do you think they will politically suffer for being seen to be so willing to deal so regularly with someone like Michael Lowry?
I suspect this is going to be a non-issue at election time. I think people understand the reality that, unfortunately, the way the last election shook out, that they were beholden to people that the country at large would prefer they were not beholden to, and that's just the sad reality.
The money spent on tribunals, the millions upon millions spent on all these things to uncover them and to show that the governments are doing something and to show that they're getting on top of all this type of previous behaviour by different administrations. And then it's just like a few years later, just come on into government.
You're right, it was a waste of time. And they're
My question would be, though, if this isn't simply like a vanity project for Michael Lowry, which it really does seem to be, something to kind of massage his ego there a little bit, I think, from this. If that's not what it is, if it is, why would something like this be necessary? And what does it say about the levels of
the weekly briefings to the regional independents?
Yes, exactly. What does that say about the way that the system within the Dáil is working at the minute, if such a thing is actually necessary? What does it say about the way that the system of questions are working? Well, obviously the committees are only getting going at this stage, or, you know, pre-legislative scrutiny and contact with departments in a real general sense. Like, what does it say about the current state of that if these regional independents feel like these weekly briefings are necessary, if it's not simply to kind of give themselves the chance of going, well, I was speaking to the minister? There should be enough built into the system that TDs, backbench TDs, opposition TDs have enough access to ministers that something like this shouldn't actually be
necessary. There's a question, John. You were, I mean, albeit in the upper house rather than in the Dáil, but when you were within the Oireachtas, to what extent did you find access possible to A, corridors of power, and B, information?
Well, I wasn't the kind of politician who was focusing on local issues. So, I mean, I didn't have individual constituents coming to ask me for things like that. I found...
You never fixed a pothole, not once in your whole career.
No, I'm afraid not. I'm afraid there's one right outside my house I'd like to see fixed. Actually, no, I told the truth, I fixed it lately. No, but I did... The access I found was informal. Like, there were ways of getting messages through to people if you wanted to have a talk about big policy issues, but you were fairly around. I must say, I think this is all vanity and marketing. I think the people on the government side of these weekly discussions know that there's nothing Michael Lowry is going to do to bring the government down. That's just not going to happen. He's going to keep them in power as long as the term of this Dáil is. And I think it's all basically just an opportunity for him to go back and tell his constituents, because you've elected me, you now have access to the levers of power. And I think it's probably sort of a non-issue. It's a little bit distasteful, but I don't actually see it having any profound significance.
If you want to get in touch, 53106 at a cost of 30 cents, or 087-1400-106 on WhatsApp. There's an interesting analysis, which we'll deal with after the break, about Ozempic and the other drugs in its coterie and the impact that it is likely to have, not just on the people who take them, but on broader society and community, because the thesis being that it will reshape what shops sell. It'll reshape travel as people flock to fly, because they are now literally, according to this piece, thin enough to so do. We'll find out about that after the break. It is the Anton Savage Show, 9 to 11 on Saturday, 10 to 12 on Sunday. With me is Ursa Savage, no relation, who is political commentator. Philip Ryan, also no relation, head of content with the Sunday Times. And Professor John Crown, oncologist and, of course, former senator. And in the medical sphere, there's a very interesting story in the Sunday Times that looks at the impact of Ozempic, not on just the people, because we know the impact, which is a shrinking of the individual, but the broader impact on society, John.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating reading. And then, you know, obviously there will be a change in business for pubs and restaurants. People, Ozempic-like drugs, the GLP-1 drugs, and we should just probably stop saying Ozempic. An interesting little sidebar on that is that the company that makes Ozempic, Novo Nordisk, this week replaced or fired their chief executive. And the main reason was that Ozempic sales have fallen off a cliff in the face of the new competitors. There are a number of other GLP-1 drugs in that space now. So Ozempic's early market share has dramatically gone down, having, you know, been an incredibly steep ascent. But these drugs also decrease all kinds of other addictive behaviors. They'll probably help people with cigarettes. They decrease your taste for alcohol as well. So it could have, you know.
Is the evidence mounting on that? Because I heard that posited a while ago and there was a suggestion that we didn't have the data yet. We now have the data.
I don't know the firm data, but I mean, certainly there has, that suggestion has been there that it does. And I know a lot of folks in the field who tell us that there is a decrease in alcohol consumption as well as food consumption. And it will affect, obviously, weight loss clinics. It will affect gymnasia. It will affect the alcohol trade.
Bookies might have a challenge.
Well, maybe. I don't know, but possibly. A really interesting one here, I see that they estimate that if Americans on average lost 10 pounds, United Airlines alone would save $80 million a year on fuel costs from having lighter passengers. It will have such, I believe, incredible positive spin-off effects in terms of decreases in cardiovascular disease, other chronic illnesses, and cancer. I mean, there's been a real recognition.
Give us that figure again. You said if the average American dropped 10 pounds, United Airlines makes,
will save $80 million a year on fuel costs, because it's that much. Mm. Americans are very obese. I mean, America has a real weight problem. And I mean, when you see these statistics comparing international health outcomes, people keep saying it's the American health system. It's mainly obesity. And it's quite striking, as the British have an obesity problem too, and they have a very different health system. But their health outcomes in general are not that different from the Americans. They're better.
But none of this is available over the counter currently, is it? You still need prescriptions. You still need a GP to decide you need it. Is that a significant barrier to people accessing?
Oh, no. No, I think you need to have these medications on prescription. Yeah, I think you do. I mean,
and to whom do you make it available? Is it the ones with morbid levels of obesity? Is it diabetics? Or is it somebody
if
who's...
If you're prepared to pay, the indications are quite wide. In Ireland, if you have diabetes, you'll be covered on the state drug scheme. And if you have, I'm not sure about this, but I think you've particularly morbid obesity problems, you may be as well. But in general, somebody who wants to lose weight who doesn't meet those criteria will end up paying for it.
But will they end up having a GP who will be willing to write the script?
I believe so. If the GP thinks there's a medical indication for it, if they think that you would benefit from weight loss, I mean, I don't think it'll be done casually for cosmetic reasons. But I mean, many of us are overweight, but are not actually morbidly obese. And even being overweight does have health implications. And people, I think the really important thing about this is that people now understand this isn't some kind of, being overweight is not some kind of a moral failure. I mean, it's a real problem. I mean, we are programmed by biology, by nature, to eat at times of plenty. And when we are in times of plenty, we will eat more, because we're programmed to survive the next ice age famine, you know, from our ancestors 100,000 years ago. And so it's a real battle to try and overcome this. And these drugs really do. And by the way, the really interesting thing, which I highlighted when I was in the Shannon, was before we had these, the surgery was incredibly effective. There was probably no medical intervention that was as successful as weight loss surgery in terms of the desired outcome, in terms of the health economic savings for the country. It became cheaper to do the surgery than to deal with the chronic illnesses that people would have had if they hadn't had the
surgery.
Because
those illnesses subsequently bring them into the system anyway.
And they were very expensive to treat.
How common do you think it is, the GLP-1s, whether Ozempic or anything else?
I think it's more common than we think, because there was a lot of talk, you know, around the time even of the Met Gala, and they were looking at these celebrities who had all lost weight, and people said, oh, it was probably that. But I think it's a lot closer to home too, and I think it's a lot closer to home than people maybe even realise. It's more, I think there's a lot more people taking these GLP-1 drugs than what we really realise, whether that's through the prescription solely, or whether people are finding other ways to access them, or, you know, people are sharing prescriptions and things like that. I don't know. And obviously that's not something that should ever be done anyway. But I think there's definitely no taboo around it anymore, this idea of taking these GLP-1s. I don't think there is. I think people have said it's an effective weight loss drug and it's what they're doing. I think what's going to be more of an issue is, you know, long term, what happens whenever people come off these drugs, or is it something that they'd want to be on for life? Because there's also evidence to suggest that once you come off these drugs that your appetite does come back. And if you haven't used the time that maybe you're on the drug to build up different health habits and to build in exercise routines and all the
more
traditional weight loss management strategies, that you could end up where you were. But in that article today in Sunday Times with Ben Spencer, I did reference that these drugs could be akin to penicillin in the 20th century in terms of the impact that it would have on the public's health. And that is massive when you think about it. It could affect absolutely every aspect, because it talks about, like you were saying there, could reduce heart attacks, cancer likelihood, depression, dementia. It says people will have fewer sick days over it. Of course, accessibility issues will be completely transformed. So I think we're really only seeing the start of it. I think in a couple of years' time, it'll be fascinating, like what's changed.
Now, Philip Ryan has taken a bullet for all of us, because he has watched the I think you watched the Eurovision personal choice. This is like Ozempic. Do you want to admit it to us?
Yeah. Well, I was in work for most of it, but it was on the background, yeah, and I had a bit of a watch.
Was the Austrian song any good?
Yeah, it was okay. It probably wasn't my favourite. I liked the Italian one. I thought that was a good little track.
Well, we were told by the judges on the Late Late Show that ours was pretty much a shoe-in. Here's some audio of when our song was picked.
So happy. Yeah, actually deserve. Because literally, that song, it's actually stuck in my head. We can sing and I can see the whole arena singing. Pam, 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 pam. And I really want to be like the guy that... Human robot is so good. Like, honestly, very deserving. Like I said, tonight they were absolutely polished. I feel like I was in Eurovision already with them, from the visuals, from the vocals, from the dancing.
So that's Arthur Gurulian talking about our chances, and kind of a swing and a miss from our perspective. Paul Harrington, who of course was a swing and a hit because won it with Charlie McGettigan for Rock and Roll Kids, is quoted today as saying, right, if ever there's a point at which we need to say enough with the Late Late Show choosing the song. He's with us this morning. Paul, is it the Late Late's fault, or is it just that we're not cranking out good enough tunes anymore?
Good morning. I can tell you, listening to the panel this morning, it would appear to be that this country has greater problems than the Eurovision, I have to tell you. But I suppose I'd be a bit like Groucho Marx. You know, I've got a set of principles here, and then I can switch them right away. I don't think the Late Late is necessarily the problem. I think there probably should be there should be a movement towards something bigger, something more exciting, perhaps a live broadcast with a live audience in somewhere like the Three Arena, and you know, to get people more involved.
Hang on a minute. How did you and Charlie McGettigan get selected?
How did we did we entered the National Song Contest, which was held in the university hall there in Limerick.
Public vote.
No juries. You know, it was all juries then. You see, the public vote has kind of distorted things, and that's why they brought back in the kind of half votes for the using juries, which does have a good effect. But look, I mean, I watched it last night myself because myself, my wife, and my daughter, it was a thing. We said we'd stick it out. We were kind of what felt like about 7 hours of it, you know. But it was God, I thought it was too long, and I found the results bizarre. I like one of your panelists there. I really like the Italian entry. Maybe that's because it was a fellow with long hair playing the piano. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was a good one. I thought it was a great tune, and the winning song, I thought it was, you know, an incredible voice. It felt like a bit of a novelty act. So I just don't know. I'd love to be able to say, you know, as I say, there's no silver bullet, but there is a silver fox, because I heard whispers of Johnny Logan was talking on a podcast he did with Nicky Byrne about the possibility of a song that he has that he thinks, if he does decide through one more time, go back in, he feels he would bring it home. So there you go.
What's another year, I suppose? Exactly. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No. Feel what
are the chances of an ensemble? Could we get yourself, McGettigan, Johnny, Neve, put everybody back together for one final hurrah?
But listen, just the thing about the late and all that sort of thing. I mean, if you don't send in something that is half decent and will get attention, I mean, you're goosed. I mean, you know, there was a great result last year. I think Bambi Thug came something, I think, sixth or thereabouts. You know, and there was a great buzz about that. There just wasn't the buzz this year. Our tune. And Emmy with the lovely story of the dog floating around in space. I mean, it was the best thing on the night, on the late, but that's the problem of that kind of, you're in a bubble there, you see. It was the best of a bad lot. So I don't think it was strong enough, and that's part of the reason. But, and then some years ago, we got through with Rhino Shocknessy, which was a terrific song, great performance. I think we probably should be more inclined to start to you know, a bit like what you were talking about earlier about we're never going back to kind of supporting a household with one wage. I think we should really accept the fact that it will be now and again that we'll break through. You know,
no, not if we get Johnny Logan back. Paul, thank you so much. Paul Harrington. And of course, you can listen to Paul on the Lyrics The Thing with Pat Kenny. He'll be on this week, as he is every week. Just briefly before we wrap up, this thing of academics, John, being wooed over to the Irish system. There's coverage, there's more coverage of it saying that it's a nice notion but unlikely to actually happen. And the thesis being the Irish system isn't attractive enough because it's underfunded. Where do you stand on
that? It's grotesquely underfunded, and the infrastructure is poorly developed, and we have a whole big, you know, absent level of lower career level jobs. You know, people that are pointing towards faculty rank and tenure that barely exist in Ireland. I mean, a lot of what I've done over the years and research has nominally been, you know, run through universities, and I'm very grateful to especially to Dublin City University for giving me the opportunity to do it. But we've basically raised the money ourselves, and the main core of the charity that I ran was to make jobs for young scientists who otherwise were, you know, being recruited into bureaucratic jobs, and like in the HSE or in the charities or in other places, when we really needed to continue doing science and cancer research. And the universities have not stood up to the plate to get that stuff done.
And will professors come over here if there isn't that research environment for them to work in?
It's not as simple as if you decide that you don't want to work in the States because of the awful stuff that's happening right now to the peer-reviewed grant process in America. It's appalling what's happening right now. One of the best things that happened in modern times was the development of academic medicine and other academic areas. But there's lots of competition. Ireland isn't the other only place, and there are lots of other attractive places to go that have better developed infrastructure and better developed systems. So we need to get our house in order if we're going to attract them.
We'll be getting a report from the US in about 5 minutes from Paul Brandis, looking at Trump's reaction to Bruce Springsteen really having a fairly serious go at his concert in Manchester, and also the latest on that Mexican Navy tall ship that crashed into the Brooklyn Bridge, killing two with dozens injured. Thank you to John Crown, oncologist and professor, Ursula Savage, political commentator, and Philip Ryan, head of content with the Sunday Times.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.